Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, the local tourism and hospitality industry is in uproar as the SAT board dismissal sparks claims of ministerial overreach. Global outrage continues to grow after a hospital in Gaza is bombed and is condemned as a war crime. A new tax on foreign pensions raises fears that South Africa could lose out on wealthy retirees. And pressure is mounting on the Tshwane mayor amid calls to pay back undue municipal overpayment. It's Wednesday, the 27th of August. The South African Tourism Services Association, under its chief executive officer David Frost, has condemned the Tourism Minister Patricia de Lille's dissolution of the South African Tourism Board, calling it legally questionable and damaging to an industry that is fighting its way back from 2 years of pandemic turbulence. With serious accusations ranging from political interference to undermining global marketing efforts, the story, I would suggest, hits at the very heart of governance, accountability, and also our image abroad. David Frost, a very warm welcome to you. And you say that the minister's decision was based on a meeting that never took place. What does that tell us, and why is that important in your opinion?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and always a treat to be with you. Just a slight correction. It's not a statement by me. This was a unanimous SATSA board resolution of 19 directors. So I speak on behalf of a very mandated and corporate SATSA on this matter. It came down to a decision the minister took in terms of legal advice she obtained, which is on a sort of a technical issue about whether there was a meeting or not. But I think, Jeremy, it's very, you know, just to, because this issue's been played out in many interviews and, you know, articles. But I just wanted to bring in a slightly different perspective on this. And this is one of just taking a step back and bringing some emotional intelligence into the equation. This is a board that the minister herself constituted at the end of September 2024. It has the best and most competent industry individuals ever assembled on South African Tourism Board. Industry leaders, CEOs of businesses with an impeccable track record. And she chose this board. It wasn't foisted on her. She didn't inherit it. But in the space of a couple of months, she has fallen totally out of kilter with the board. She appointed a chair, a social scientist from UWC, instead of one of the industry leaders with board experience. There was a disjuncture between the board and the chairman to the extent that it ended up with a vote of no confidence. But this was brought to her attention along the way. But at the nub of it, Jeremy, is a forensic report, independent forensic report that the board received in April this year. They didn't commission it. It came from a previous board and an irregular finding by the Auditor General, which directly raised issues about the current CEO and recommended remedial action. The board is obliged to act, and they did so. They kept the minister abreast. They saw to a concurrence. But rather than sit down with the board, and these are your people that you've assembled, this is your team, and talk this through and get onto the same page, she obfuscates, she kicks for touch, and you know, if I ask enough, you know, hundreds of thousands of questions and ask this and that, you know, this thing, let's kick the can down the road. There's a very interesting parallel here, Jeremy. I served on the board of South African Tourism under Minister Derek Hunnicombe, and Sisa and Shauna, who was a previous CEO, was implicated in alleged wrongdoing. Minister Hanekom immediately met with our board, chaired ably by Pam Yucca, and we had a deputy chair in Tanya Abramson. And it's instructive, Minister DeLille has not appointed a deputy chair. She had 9 months to do so. But Hanekom sat with us. He said, I have every confidence in you as a board. This is your job. You've got to do this. But what support do you need from me? That's ministerial. This behavior from Patricia DeLille in this thing is highly questionable. And really, I think, is unbecoming of a minister.
Which begs the question, David Frost, what do you think the motive is?
Well, Jeremy, I mean, I really don't want to get into that realm of speculation. But, you know, she put a statement out that said she got rid of the board because they'd held a meeting. The board pushed back saying we didn't actually have a meeting. It was a round robin resolution, which she's now recanted if you listen to the interviews she's done now. And she's sort of come out fighting. But in one of the interviews, Jeremy, she calls herself, I'm a smiling dictator. Now, what are we meant to do? Just chuckle that away? No, we do. This is South Africa. Her behavior is out of the Trumpian playbook or out of something out of Saudi Arabia. We're not those countries. We're a democracy. We have corporate governance. Zondo goes in. He's a whole chapter in the Zondo Commission about ministerial overreach and roles and responsibilities. She put that board in place. Trust your board. It's their job to execute their fiduciary duty. They were doing so with all the good intentions in the world. And she has come in to obfuscate that process and to take the draconian step of dismissing an entire board. I mean, sometimes you've got to look at yourself, Minister, because you put them in place.
You'll be happy, David Frost, that the dissolved board is now planning court action to challenge this. You would support that, no doubt, as an organisation.
In our statement, we support their legal challenge, absolutely. I understand they're serving papers today, and I think it's right and proper that this matter is sort of ventilated in the court. And then I think it's also very important that the Portfolio Committee is seeing both the minister and the dissolved board on Tuesday. And I mean, Jeremy, just to put it into perspective, I mean, and one might chuckle on this. It's very rare in politics, and you've been in the game a long time, that the EFF and the DA are totally aligned on something, and they are totally aligned in their opposition to the minister's actions in this respect.
Is it too early to start measuring the economic or reputational fallout?
I think it definitely is. But let me say the following. Is that SAT as an organization has been dysfunctional now for a number of years. We in the private sector do not see value. They do not communicate their business plans. They do their own thing. And I must just say, in the last 2 years under the now suspended CEO, the performance has been abysmal. We've had the worst meetings Africa on record. Indaba was a shambles. We have had sight of their country plans. They really aren't worth the paper they're written on. They've come up with a ridiculous ad about people floating around and finding new joy. The private sector, almost to a person, just finds it laughable. But so the private sector spends its own money marketing the country and indeed outspends SA Tourism by almost 20 to 1. So the private sector is resilient. We will get out and continue to do the good work. It would be so good at some stage to have a functioning SAT. And this board was well on its way to making that happen. There were good people. From a private sector point of view, we could transact and start to do things with them. And everything was on track. It's the minister that's actually unfortunately burnt the bridge.
David Frost, very quickly, what in your opinion or in SATSA's opinion would a clean resolution look like that restores trust but also is clean and transparent?
Well, I mean, I think the minister needs to recant. I think she really needs to take a cold shower. And I want to say, Jeremy, and the minister will know this, when she first came in, we were totally behind her. As I was behind the CEO at SAT, we gave them every support. And, you know, we had good engagements. But you cannot take a step of this nature and just sort of shrug it off and, you know, laugh away that I'm a smiling dictator. You know, reinstate the board, we will continue with the good programs and we will get stuff done and let the process take its course. The CEO's been suspended. There'll be an inquiry. If indeed she is not guilty of the associations, that's the way she clears her name. And that happened with Sisa and Shauna. He was cleared of the wrongdoing and, you know, life went on.
Thank you very much indeed. That's the Chief Executive Officer of the Southern Africa Tourism Services Association, David Frost.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
International news now, and a devastating double-tap airstrike on Gaza's Nasser Hospital, its last functioning public hospital in the south, has killed scores of people, you would have read, including five journalists, and continues today to draw sharp global condemnation. With mounting accusations of potential war crimes and calls for urgent accountability, Zinat Adam from the Afro Middle East Center is going to join me now. I want to try and discuss and dissect the legal, humanitarian, and geopolitical fallout. Zinat, a very warm welcome. For maybe just a broad assessment, first of all, on the strike as far as international humanitarian law is concerned. What are your thoughts?
Well, the first thing, Jeremy, is that this is a hospital, and hospitals are protected during war in terms of the Geneva Conventions. So already that in itself is a violation of international law. The second is the deliberate targeting of journalists. And we say deliberate targeting specifically in the case of this double tap, because the area in which this attack happened is a stairwell that has been known to be utilized by journalists on a regular basis in order to be able to catch the Wi-Fi signals. So it was known that journalists spend their time in the stairwell trying to get a signal. And on the day that this tap happened, Israel is now claiming, after the apology, to say that yes, it was a deliberate strike, because they believed that one of the cameras that was being utilized was an advanced camera used for surveillance. This particular camera was being used by one of the journalists, Hossam, who was working for Reuters, and he was having a live feed at the time of the strike. Then the third international violation, well, journalists are also protected in international law. Then the third one is the double tap. This is a particularly brutal methodology that is used by Israel and others in throughout the world. During Iraq, I remember the same kind of modus operandi used, whereby an attack happens. There is a waiting period of about 10 minutes, and then a second strike happens at the same site. And this is a deliberate targeting of the civil defense and civilians, as well as the journalists who go into that strike to try and cover what has just happened, and they become the secondary victims.
There's a lot of discussion globally now about whether this attack constitutes a war crime or if it's just a pattern of policy.
In my opinion, this is a war crime, and it should be regarded as such. We cannot be looking at 278 journalists killed. Of those, 273 are Palestinian in the period of 2 years of genocide. It doesn't make sense. This is the highest number ever recorded. And what we've also found is, besides this particular attack, Jeremy, is there's been a pattern of being able to geolocate the Palestinian journalists by tapping into their phones, by making calls to them, and then attacking. And this is exactly how the attack last week on Anas al-Sharif and his colleagues from Al Jazeera were killed as well.
I'm just looking at a statement from the United Nations Human Rights Office. It's quoting a Tamin al-Ketan, who speaks for the organization, and I quote, saying this is a shock and is unacceptable. Goes on to say this raises many questions about the targeting of journalists, and all those incidents must be absolutely investigated, and those held responsible must be held accountable. All well and good, but we've heard rhetoric like this in the past with very little follow-up.
Well, let's look at even before the genocide. This is really a pattern of how Israel conducts its occupation. And we can remember Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed just a few years ago, and that was in the West Bank. Also a journalist working for Al Jazeera, and targeted while she was in the field. So this is not something new. It's just been escalated to a point of unfathomable carnage in Gaza.
Let's look then at the implication or the consequence. These repeated strikes, what impact are you able to discern in terms of the collapse of the healthcare infrastructure within the region?
Nasser Hospital is the last standing hospital in this area of Gaza City that is still being able to service the civilians who are victims of this war, not just from the attacks as a result of the war, but also from the famine and also from the resulting diseases that are cropping up. And so we've seen this as a pattern also from Israel throughout the genocide. At the very beginning, they denied any attacks on the hospitals. And then the excuses came that beneath these hospitals are tunnels that Hamas utilizes. Now, there have been several medical people who have come from outside of Gaza who have been working as medical professionals, doctors, nurses, and paramedics who have come out of Gaza on several occasions and repeatedly told the world that this is not true. I want to also point out, Jeremy, that on the day of this particular attack on Nasser Hospital, that a number of these international medical workers received notifications from Israel on their phones to tell them to evacuate. So they very much want to protect international workers, but any of the Palestinians are collateral damage or are then targeted, and it is said that they work for Hamas.
In the past 24 hours, we have seen a lot of international outrage, but I guess the question is whether it's going to translate into any meaningful diplomatic pressure, or is apathy winning out at the end here?
We heard from the Qatari mediation yesterday from their spokesperson, who sounded very resigned and very frustrated in his statements, indicating to us that there is still no response from Israel after having received notification from Hamas 2 weeks ago that they are willing to negotiate and to now finalize a truce of at least 60 days. On the day that that was announced, Israel concurrently announced their incursion into Gaza City and began to recruit up to 80,000 reservists to join the IDF for Operation Gideon Chariots 2. Today, in Washington, President Trump will be hosting post-war plans, a discussion about what Gaza is going to be like post-war. This is really concerning because the implication then is that Gaza will be completely eroded to dust and that a plan will be put forward on the rebuilding in a very capitalistic style and that Palestinians will be completely displaced and ethnically cleansed from this region.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Zinat Adam from the Afro Middle East Center. Zinat, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, National Treasury's draft tax bill scraps the long-standing exemption on foreign pension income for South African tax residents, meaning, as I understand it, those pensions and lump sums would be taxed here subject to treaties from the 2026 tax year. Professional services firm BDO warning the move could put wealthy foreign retirees off settling in South Africa. So let's try and make some sense of all of this. John Paul Fraser is with me from Tax Consulting South Africa. John Paul, a very warm welcome. So in plain English then, what exactly changes versus the current exemption? Who suddenly pays tax?
So, and this is a very important question to start with. I mean, for general South Africans, not a problem at all, because we don't generally have foreign pension funds. Those, however, who have worked abroad, earned foreign pensions, and those who are foreign individuals coming into South Africa are going to bear the brunt of this change. So essentially, currently what's happened is we exempt foreign pension funds under certain conditions. Social Security, for example, and compulsory, let's say, contributions via employment, similar to South Africa. That is taxed under, like you say, tax treaties. They want to change that to be based on tax residency. So essentially, what was previously non-taxable in South Africa is going to be totally taxable, subject to tax treaties, obviously. That's in layman's terms what essentially is going to be happening.
And John Paul, are there any groups that might be excluded by these treaties? I understand that it hits returning South Africans and foreign retirees. Does anyone catch a break here?
Well, if you have a foreign pension fund, quite simply, and you trigger, firstly, if you have left and are returning and you re-trigger tax residency, this will be applicable to you. If you are coming to South Africa as a foreign individual, just because you're entering South Africa and spending a little bit of time here, might have an investment property, etc., it doesn't affect you. But if you're triggering tax residency, it will then have a severe impact on you. So in terms of those who catch a break, it's those who at least know how to navigate tax residency. Outside of that, the only other saving grace you have is your respective tax treaty. And they do differ country to country, for example. So very important. Mm.
Government, as I understand it, says the aim is to stop, and I quote, double non-taxation. Practically, how big a problem is that? And would double taxation still occur despite DTAs?
So, excellent question. And this is an incredibly problematic scenario we're currently facing. I mean, I deal with individuals entering into the country all the time and have to advise on their structure and what their tax implications are. So UK, as there's a big export of South Africans to the UK individuals love coming to South Africa. So their DTA, for example, is one that is problematic. That allows for double non-taxation. The treaty will say you pay tax on your pension where you are a tax resident. So if they are taxed there, leave the UK, come to South Africa, trigger tax residency here. Our domestic local South African tax law says, but we exempt that. So actually, that individual is coming here to retire is really winning because he's not paying any tax on that. So in terms of the change, I mean, we've got individuals who have set up their life. Retirement is a very important aspect of life. And it was actually one of the most critical things in terms of the wealth tax discussion, by the way, is how do we deal with the retirement funds? It's almost meant to be, if I could say, sacred. So now we've got individuals who've entered the country, set up their life, and all of a sudden, on which might to them be very short notice, next year there could be implementation of all of a sudden their foreign pensions being taxed. Separately, those individuals who are, and I'm talking real examples I've consulted with this week. I mean, we're talking incredibly wealthy individuals from around the world, head of big corporate banks, etc., want to retire in South Africa. And based on this amendment, they actually have changed their mind.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, there's a real downside here. There is a warning that wealthy retirees might not choose South Africa. Difficult, though, to quantify the potential loss of investment and spend. It's really about the optics, which you've pointed out.
Correct. So, I mean, it really is. Firstly, it will come down to tax treaties. Bearing in mind, we'd still first consider local tax law. But if there's another tax treaty such as, let's say, New Zealand, that would say New Zealand is the right to tax it, then we'd have to consider the international tax treaty. As in our law, we are also compelled to consider that too. So it doesn't mean it's a be-all and end-all, but it does mean that there initially will be double tax. And secondly, it is about the optics. Perhaps there's other countries, for example, well, Belgium has one of your highest tax rates on income. There's other countries who maybe you're happy to be a South African tax resident to pay tax on your foreign pension and rather pay here than there, for example. So it really does depend on the optics, like as you said, Jeremy.
Is there any policy alternative that might protect South Africa's attractiveness without opening loopholes?
Well, I think for the time being, you need to consider your tax treaty. That really is the most important thing at this stage. Wherever you are a tax resident, bearing in mind at this stage, if you are still, well, one of the first most important things, if I may say, Jeremy, a lot of South Africans have not formalized their non-tax residency. So they are living abroad for, let's say, 20 years. I mean, the longest one I've done is I've backdated a non-residency application to 1987. So there's individuals all around the world who are unaware that now they'll be paying tax on their foreign pensions because they've not formalized their non-tax residency with SARS. So that's the starting point. Secondly, I mean, maybe not something you can, a policy change, but I mean, generally your retirement funds and specifically the wording in your double tax treaties, it covers pensions, retirement annuities, and all similar income. So it really is entirely encumbersome of those kind of policies. So if you're talking about a specific policy, unfortunately, not really. There's no real way around this removal of this exemption in that sense.
And John Paul Fraser, tell me about timeline. When does all of this bite? And at this point, would there be transitional rules for people already drawing a foreign pension?
So the first and most important thing is comments are open. Obviously, we live in a democracy, and this involves the National Treasury as well as SARS. So comments on proposed amendments, closure is 12 September. I mean, it's just over 2 weeks, 3 weeks away. So I do encourage everyone who can, please do submit comments. As you note, this is incredibly short notice because this does take effect next year from the 1st of March. That is very short notice for people who have planned their entire life for something and to be given, let's say, a couple months' notice that all of a sudden their plans are not really applicable anymore. It's a very scary thing to do. So, yeah, the comments, firstly. And then, secondly, alternative to that is where you can try consult a tax specialist, specifically cross-border tax specialist. This is a very niche area of law. So tax treaties are incredibly important because that's, like I said, whatever that dictates doesn't mean that just because SARS wants to tax your foreign pension that your now treaty is all of a sudden irrelevant. So that's a very good starting point, if I may say.
And just a quick one, assuming this does go through, and there's every likelihood, are there specific documents that SARS will expect?
Well, the scary thing, and this is a whole other topic, Jeremy, is what's currently going on as we speak is the OECD, which is the international organization that actually runs our current treaty models, as well as the African tax organizations, various of them, all working on the automatic exchange of information. So whether you provide documents to us or not, once a year, there's going to be an automatic exchange between tax authorities on individuals. So generally, like normal tax, you'd have to submit source documents, income source documents, a source of funds, etc. Even if you don't, the scary thing is what's currently happening behind the scenes is that not very long from now, even if you don't, it's going to be automatically provided and exchanged to SARS. So just to be aware of that as well.
John Paul Fraser from Tax Consulting SA, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Democratic Alliance in Tshwane is demanding answers from Mayor Nasipi Moya after allegations she may have been one of several senior officials overpaid during the 2019-2020 financial year. Now, despite repeated questions and commitments to provide clarity, the mayor has yet to confirm, I understand, whether she personally benefited from so-called undue payments or if she's paid the money back. With growing concerns about transparency and accountability at City Hall, the DA's finance spokesman in Tshwane, Councillor Jackie Ace, is with me. Councillor, very warm welcome. First of all, how much money are we talking about?
Hi, Jeremy. Up until this morning, we did not have confirmation of either the amount or the fact that the mayor was indeed overpaid. However, about half an hour ago, we did receive a letter from the mayor after the press release yesterday, where the mayor admitted that she was overpaid with 270,000 rand. And that she has now finally, after public pressure, signed a payment arrangement in order to repay this money to the city.
All well and good, but how did this happen? How does a mayor get overpaid?
So at the time, the mayor was a senior official in the city. She was working in the office of the chief whip and then later in the office of the executive mayor. And there was overpayment done to 78 different senior officials, of which the majority of them has made payment arrangements or paid back the money. Processes was also started to investigate how it happened and to keep the officials responsible for this overpayment to account. The process where we started to ask these questions was tying up the loose ends to ensure that all 78 officials actually do pay back the money. And we will now continue to keep our eye on this process and to ensure that the commitment from the mayor is actually adhered to and that the money is paid back.
In total, how much money are we talking about if you look at the officials as well?
Well, it was 78 officials, and the majority of them, I believe, had payments of in the same range of this 270,000 rand.
It's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, yes.
Do you view this as an error or part of wider irregularities within the finances of the metro?
This is what the MFMA Section 32 investigation process had to look at. And now, at the time, there was a benchmarking exercise where the city moved from up a classification in a classified municipality. And the overpayment happened in the period that the reclassification was done. And there was calculations that had to happen. But the Section 32 investigations, that is what needs to prove on whether there was malpractice, whether it was on purpose, or whether this was a miscalculation. What is the most important is the fact that it was picked up and that it has to be rectified. And we are therefore glad that finally the mayor has opened up towards this. It is unfortunately, in her case, the second time where it has been brought to public attention that she received money from the municipality and was unduly paid to her, and she never paid it back. The first was an amount of 10,000 rand that was paid to her for an overseas trip that she never went on when she was working in the office of the mayor. And that amount was also only paid back after she became deputy mayor in 2023.
Councillor,
so there is a pattern that that seems to be here, that the mayor is not taking the lead when it comes to the responsibility of the city's finances.
And councillor, without giving an overtly political answer to this question, and I'm sure you will, how does this affect public confidence in the city's leadership?
Well, we find now that this is the second senior politician. The rest is, the first one was the deputy mayor, that seemed to unduly benefit from the municipality's finances. And the question here is on transparency, number one, but also on number two, on how serious is this administration taking the fact that we are working with public money and that we need to work responsibly with this money. And I think that is the most important question that we need to have answered. And that is the most important thing that, as the opposition, the DA will be focusing on.
And
I try to give you an objective answer.
And
there.
I do appreciate it. Just in conclusion, what needs to be tightened then to force better accountability to prevent something like this from happening in the future?
Well, the mayor, if she is asked a direct question, must not give us a runaround for 6 months. There must be a responsibility from their side. Unfortunately, we have now seen that there isn't that type of responsibility and that it will take relentless pressure from the DA and often having to go to the resort of public pressure to ensure that this happens. But we will continue to do so. We will continue to keep the government to account. And ultimately, it is only a strong DA that will be able to ensure these type of corrections to be made.
That is Councillor Jackie Ace, the DA finance spokesman in the Tshwane Metro. Thank you very much for joining me today. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.